and welcome to the GVA Legal Podcast. My name is Jean Kambwini and I'm your host. Today, we want to double back to a conversation we had a few weeks ago on artificial intelligence. We're running a two-part series on AI, and part one focused on understanding AI in general, its opportunities and threats. Today, we're recording part two of the AI series, and we want to discuss the ethical and legal implications of AI. To discuss this topic, in studio with me is Alfred Ongere. Alfred is the founder of AI Kenya. Welcome, Alfred.
Thank you very much.
And I want us to begin with just understanding who AI Kenya is and the type of work that you're doing before we delve into the topic at hand today. So who is AI Kenya? What do you do? And why were you inspired to start it and do this?
Okay. AI Kenya is an initiative meant to grow the adoption of artificial intelligence in Kenya. So generally, it's an ecosystem building initiative that started in 2017. And how I started it is, while I was in university, I was involved in a program called the Intel Student Partner Program that was meant to train students and develop a in the country on emerging technologies such as Internet of Things and artificial intelligence. So I was in that program for 2 years and I trained students on IoT and AI. So that was my introduction to AI. And while going around the country, just training students and the general public, I saw how the gap was still very big in terms of knowledge on what AI was and where to get started. And I decided to start AI Kenya. And another thing that also led me to start it was I was in an entrepreneurship program in Boston for 3 weeks. It's called the TREP Camp Entrepreneurship Bootcamp. And I was exposed to the developer and startup community in Boston. And AI was one of the amazing technologies that that ecosystem were trying to build. And they were doing it openly. So they just organized a meetup and they decided to tackle a problem using AI technology, such as a smart assistant, such as Amazon Echo. And I was just amazed how it was a free event. You are not paying anything, but you're just convening and it's smart people just talking about technology and what they're building and asking for feedback and collaboration. So that really amazed me. So when I came back to the country, I started AI Kenya. And the first instance of it was a community group that essentially was bringing together researchers, developers, hobbyists, and enthusiasts who were interested in AI. So we started doing monthly events ranging from technical to non-technical events such as fireside chats, hands-on technical workshops, data science hackathons, and documentary screenings. So we do a mix of both because we consider ourselves both a tech and non-tech community. So the community has really grown. And we provide people a platform where they can come together, engage. So we have a meetup platform for that. We also have a WhatsApp group and a Telegram group where anyone can join, ask questions on AI, share their projects. If they're looking to hire people, they can also do that and so on. So it's been mostly around growing AI in Kenya and also contributing to conversations whenever we are called upon to speak at different events, either at a national level or even international level, to give our perspectives on how we see AI advancing on a global scale.
And I like what you've been doing. Like thinking about it from 2017, you're at 6-7 years yes. of working on AI. And I think that gives you what they call, I think it's Malcolm Gladwell who calls this 10,000 hours. 10,000 yes. hours on AI. Yes. So I feel like you've garnered enough time spent analyzing how AI works in Kenya. What yeah. are the entry points it would have? What are the challenges? What are the cultural nuances that yeah. you're able to speak authoritatively about it? And for me, I found interesting. In fact, you can go on, they have AI Kenya has a very robust YouTube YouTube presence and channel. And you can go back and see even the things that they've done in the past. They do very good viewings of documentaries. I think there's one I watched for on the cleaners, the people who sit behind the desks and look at the content that we post and determine whether it's worth sharing or not. Yes. And I think that those viewings are very interesting. I encourage any of our listeners to just go out and look at that content that they put out. It's very thought-provoking, I think is the word. Thought-provoking content is the word. Yeah. As you look at the future of AI, where do you think Kenya is going? Like having those 10,000 hours, where are we as a country? And you can look at this looking at the change. I mean, you've been there since, say, 2017 was like there was nothing. Or there was very little knowledge and very few very smart people who knew what was happening. Yeah. And how that has changed now, especially now that I feel like, I think we all knew that AI existed, but it was back there and not very visible, and we didn't understand. We felt like it was preying on us as opposed to using it constructively. Like now I can see people thinking about how they can use ChatGPT to draft things of theirs, and it stopped being as scary as it was. So how's that change been over those 6-7 years?
So I'd say the biggest spike in terms of interest, of course, has been in the past 1 year and present because of tools such as ChatGPT that are now being made more accessible to anyone who wants to use them. So they've been there, they've been in the background, but they've mostly been accessible to researchers who know how to play around with them or take them and build whatever they want. But now they've been packaged into a channel that you can go and just type on a chatbot or on a website and you're able to access it. So that will really open up people's minds in terms of the capabilities of these technologies and how they can start using these technologies to automate their work, to assist them in their daily tasks, and also just help them imagine the next big solution that they want to create. So I see that we'll have a spike in terms of digital businesses and digital solutions. We'll have more outsourced solutions on a global scale. We are an English-speaking economy, and we have so many youth who are well-oriented to become gig workers. So I see it's a very optimistic sort of overview when I look at AI, merely by the capability that now it's in people's hands and they can really, really use it. It's being made more accessible. So I'd say it's really interesting times.
Yeah. It is. And I want to now challenge you a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Having been in the space for the length of time that you have been in, you have seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I want us to now start talking about these things.
Yeah.
And I want us to start with the idea of machine learning.
Yeah.
How exactly do AI systems train themselves? How exactly does an AI system learn?
So there are different techniques that can be used to train a machine learning system. There are basically three major types. One of them is supervised learning. The other is unsupervised learning and reinforcement learning. So for supervised learning, you're basically supervising the process of training the machine or the software to identify different things. So you are teaching it, for example, to distinguish between a cat and a dog. So you'll tell it a cat has these particular features and a dog has these particular features. So use these particular features to identify dogs and cats in any future pictures that I give you. And then in unsupervised learning, you want the model to just identify patterns that are common in a data that you present to it. So you might give it pictures of, let's say, 1,000 people and ask it to identify the common features. So it might start narrowing down nose, ears, eyes, and so on. Or in another case, let's say you take a data set of how banks give loans to different people, and then the machine is able to draw graphs and patterns and identify that a certain group of people who have been paying their loans early or immediately or are loyal to the bank are given more loans as compared to people who take very long to repay their loans and so on. And then lastly, for reinforcement learning, you you are teaching the machine something, but you are rewarding it. So you give it a goal. I'll give a classic example of the snake game that I'm sure most people have played on Nokia phones or any other phone that you
except
might have.
Gen Z.
Except Gen Z. Gen Z might not know that, but they can just go on Google snake game. And it's a game where there's food for the snake to eat. And once the snake eats the food, the snake gets longer. Mm-hmm. And it's the snake is confined to a rectangular block. And the snake should not hit itself because it will end up eating itself. So in this case, you are training the machine and telling it, find the best path possible to eat the food and get longer. And I will reward you by giving you more points every time that you
we
eat
do
the
that.
Food.
Yeah.
But if you eat yourself or if you hit a block of a wall, then the game ends. So the machine will keep trying to find the best path forward. So those are just some of the three techniques that can be used to train machine learning models. Yeah.
And I find it interesting that machine learning mirrors the learning of children. You know,
yes.
When I became a parent, I became really obsessed with watching or trying to understand how exactly children learn, how they grow. And one of the documentaries I watched about how children learn, yeah. many of the children learn through the same methods that you're talking about. So it's supervised learning. So a parent or a caregiver instructs the child on what a particular object is,
yeah.
or it's unsupervised learning. And that was what I found particularly interesting. In fact, that you say that an AI can do that, I find interesting because yeah. I think I watched one in that documentary, they were giving an explanation of how a child narrows down to a particular object or a person's name
yes.
by eliminating every time they interact with multiple objects. So for instance, in this room, we have lots of chairs and we have microphones and we have our computers
yeah.
and the child is told the word may be computer. So looks around and sees the microphones, the set that we have, the people that are there, and then they bank the word in their head, but they
yeah.
don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Then the next time the word computer is said, they look at the things around and they eliminate the things that were there before, but are
yes.
not there again.
So they're both
then
true.
Narrowed down until at some point they know yeah. that computer is this instrument that is before you that you use to type and write in it. And then also there's the reinforcement learning. So where
yeah.
sometimes we use it to teach good behavior. So
yes.
if you do this, then
you'll
I will
punished.
Give you this, or you're
yeah.
punished or you're rewarded. Based off of the behavior that the child gets. So it's very interesting that AI systems learn in that way.
Yeah.
But for
yeah.
them to be able to learn,
yes.
they have to go through massive data sets.
Yes.
And these data sets have to come from someplace.
Yeah.
So there are two probable issues that I see here. So one,
yeah.
there's a lot of AI-driven analysis of sensitive personal data.
Yeah.
How is the data of these individuals who either knowingly or unknowingly are giving their information to AI systems being protected?
So this depends on the party that's creating the machine learning model. So of course, there are the guidelines and frameworks that are industry standards that are set out for different parties to use when they're collecting people's data. But at the end of the day, different organizations will always decide to be malicious and take advantage of people and not inform them that we are collecting this data from you, or not disclose that this is how you're going to use this particular data. But even that, even after they've collected data and now that they have it and it has this personal information and personal nuances such as race and gender and so on that might be very sensitive and might transfer the wrong logic to the machine learning model depending on how it is sampled or how it is collected. So there are different techniques that can be used to ensure privacy for the end user. One of them is anonymization of personal identifiable information. So if you're dealing with text data, you just decide to delete the columns that have personal identifiable information, your name, your gender, your race, and so on. And those might be columns that might not necessarily affect the outcome of the machine learning model. So you need to remove them. In other cases, you might use techniques such as federated machine learning, which is in one instance, you have the machine learning model running on the device. So I don't need to send your data to the cloud for me to process your data and then give you an output. So one example of that might be the facial recognition systems on your phone, right? So it it will just automatically scan the data you're giving it, but that data is processed within your phone. It does not leave your phone to go to the cloud, and then the cloud will have your data and use it for future training purposes. So there are so many techniques that are industry standards that are recommended when we are building machine learning models. But at the end of the day, organizations will take shortcuts, or just for different malicious reasons, they'll decide not to take those particular guidelines in place.
Now, and to ask a follow-up question. So I'm sure many people have watched the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma.
Yes.
And that explains how what we call engagement AI works.
Yes.
And that's especially on social media, even on just on your computer, on your search engines,
yeah.
that you have engagement AI that just tracks what you look at
yeah.
and then curates your feed or your search history
yes.
to either keep you there
yeah.
or to be relevant to you. So I don't
yeah.
always see engagement AI as bad because
yeah.
it's garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
So if I don't want to see weird things, don't look at weird things.
Yes.
Then it doesn't come back at you. So
yes.
personally, I'm ambivalent about engagement AI because I've tried to curate my content so that it
yeah.
gives me back exactly what I want.
Yeah.
So now, but how can we ensure that our privacy is not infringed by an invasive AI system? Can there be an invasive AI system?
I have a different or interesting perspective on it. It might be the same to yours, or it might be a completely different direction. So think of AI as a tool. So I'll use the example of a knife. So in the hands of a chef, it's a tool that's helping you make food. In the hands of a criminal, it's a weapon that can harm you. So that's the same thing to AI. It's a powerful tool, which if misused will have the wrong sort of results. But if it is used in the right way, it will give you the right results. I also watched that particular documentary, and being a practitioner who understands how AI system works and how it affects people's lives, I felt that the documentary was really sided towards highlighting the negative effects of what goes wrong when AI systems are not properly tuned or they're not properly monitored, right? Do a very good job of showing the positive side, or how those particular issues are being tackled. So in science, when you're building something, you of course will always have in the experiment phase, things will always go wrong. However, you're not supposed to focus on the parts of the experiment where they really, really go wrong. Instead, why did it go wrong and what can we improve for the future experiments? There was this other story where a drone, it was going around in the media. I was not able to fact check it, but the story was they were training drones. They were piloting drones autonomously. The drones were controlling themselves. And there were different people in the room. And then the drones ended up attacking the people in the room. So I guess this was in a military or defense facility, sort of
yeah.
environment.
Mm-hmm.
And the story that was on the headlines was the AI on the drones turns and attacks people in the room. But for me, I would be interested in more details, like what exactly went wrong for someone to end up being attacked. So a journalist, because of selling a story and getting clicks on their news and just, you know, feeding the current appetite for AI stories, would paint it in such a way that the system is the one
that failed
in the wrong. But essentially, it's the person who created the system, like what measures are they put in place to take care of such particular cases. So most of the time, I always have a very optimistic view of AI as a tool, but in the context of the engagement case, the recommendation engine does what it's meant to do. It will amplify what you want it to amplify to you. But at the end of the day, it gets to a level where science is very, very precise, or it over-delivers on what it's supposed to do. So I don't feel like we should victimize it for that. However, we should take that discovery and then look at it really did a good job in this particular case. So where can we apply it so that it can have more impact in people's lives?
And I think what you're encouraging us to do is look at AI, as Chimamanda says, there's a danger in a single story. So yes. Don't just focus on one side of the story.
Yes.
Look at the other side, then you'll be able to have a more holistic opinion on its value too.
Yeah.
But I want now to come now to ownership.
Yes.
I think right now we've gotten to a point where AI is almost indistinguishable from reality. I mean, yeah. A few weeks ago, there was some buzz on social media yeah. about an AI-generated image that won the Sony World Photography Awards.
Yes.
You know, that's a very prestigious award on
yeah.
very emotive, poignant, if I can call it that, pictures. And yeah. that picture, that and I saw it, like it came up on my Twitter feed.
Yeah.
And I read into the story. I was just following it. And I found it very interesting that this guy, this photographer, I forget his name, not only submitted it to just, you know, like as part of advocacy to illustrate the power that we have with AI right now, but then also fessed up when it won. He's like, by the way, I didn't take that picture. That picture is AI generated.
Yes.
But now it brings to question that particular image. If a machine can learn on its own, and
yeah.
as AI machines do, and it can generate very beautiful images such as those, some that are composites of other things in the past, but who owns that intellectual property? Would the owner then be developer of the AI system?
Yeah.
The requester of that particular image, like
yeah.
the guy?
Yeah.
Or the machine itself?
So looking at the base principles of even the IP rights, or how patents are awarded, or how we recognize an original piece, the person who creates it is the one who owns it, right? But innovation does not stop there. Someone will always come, look at what you've done, and provide an improved version of whatever you've created. And that person will still get credit for that particular innovation. So it doesn't mean the first person didn't get credit. They're still credited, but you're just adding more layers of credit based on what different people create. So in this case, in terms of who owns the IP for, let's say, that AI-generated photograph. So I'd say it depends on the data that was used to train this particular machine learning model. Was it data that is
open source,
available on the internet, and anyone can just take it, look at it, and then get an idea? Or was it data that was illegally acquired from somewhere else? Then that completely changes the story. Then there's the element of the person who created the machine learning model that now takes this image and generates another. So what licensing terms have they defined for the outputs of this particular machine learning model? Are they saying anything that this model gives you is open source, or anything that this model gives you, you can use it, but you have to pay for it because there's time and resources that have gone to get you to use it. So based on that, I'd say there are many moving parts, but most of the time, the person who gives the prompt to generate this particular image is the one who has initiated or inspired the machine or instructed the machine to give me this version of what I want. So in this case, and if you look at platforms such as Midjourney and Stable Diffusion or even ChatGPT, they have different rules on ownership on the output based on if it's a free plan, you don't own it. It's still, or if you use it, you have to attribute that it came from that particular system. If it's a paid plan, there are certain limitations. There are some that you fully own it, you can say it's your own, or you still have to credit that you got it from that particular place. So I'd say, in summary, it depends with what has been defined by the person who has created that particular machine learning model and what rights they're transferring to whoever is keying in the prompts to get what they want.
Now, I want to double back to something that you just spoke about. You spoke about a media story about a drone that was being tested. I don't know if it was being tested, but it was being used.
Yeah.
And then it turned and attacked the people in the room.
Yeah.
And I want to ask about liability, because I feel like after you've spoken about ownership and credit,
yeah.
you have to now come back to the other side, because ownership is everything has gone well.
Yeah.
So now we are trying to divide the spoils of the goodness that we've gotten from AI.
Yeah.
But sometimes things do go wrong.
Yes.
So now when who is liable when an AI fails to perform its function or it functions incorrectly? We're starting to get into this place where you have this driverless vehicle. So yes. If you have a driverless vehicle that runs over a pedestrian or an AI system diagnoses a medical condition incorrectly,
yeah.
Who then is liable for that failure?
I'd say the person who is liable is the person who is using the output of the AI. So in this case, if it's a self-driving car, the person who is in the car is liable at the end of the day.
But they cannot control the AI. The AI is driving itself.
Why I say that is every system has limitations in terms of what it can do. So there are two categories of AI. We have weak AI that will do specific tasks. If it is writing a book, so like ChatGPT, if it's writing a book, it's very good at writing a book and other text-generated work cases. If it's something like drawing and you have a system such as Midjourney, it's specifically good at that, right? And then you have strong AI or super AI, which can do multiple things, right? So it's like a human. So it can see, it can hear, it can sing, it can walk, it can navigate, it can do all those. So right now we don't have any system that has reached that particular level of super AI. What we mostly have is systems that are very good at doing particular tasks.
So let me pause you there before you continue, because I'm seeing your thought is going, but I want to just throw in something.
Yeah.
Tesla.
Yes.
Is it a Tesla that has an AI system that can identify objects in front of it?
Yes.
And then either come to a stop or, just has a database through which it identifies things, and then it's able to drive the car in essence. It can override the user of the car and bring the car to a stop should it be required to. Now, in that type of AI, with the way you're explaining it to me, there's an assumption that it is infallible.
Yeah.
So what happens if that particular type of AI fails? Because there have been viral videos of where it's unable to identify something like a horse and carriage.
Yes.
Because it doesn't have that system within it. So what happens if that type of system fails, or a different system? So maybe for the medical users, so a system that just is supposed to recognize your patterns and then determine what diagnosis to give you. What happens if that fails? Or are we still using the human as a failsafe?
We're using the human as a failsafe because before such a system is used or released to the public, it has to pass through different standard checks. And now the example you've chosen is very good of autonomous driving. It's heavily regulated in countries that are supporting such vehicles. And the reason they do that is the systems have not reached a level where they can really fully drive themselves in any area. So they are limited with the environment around them, whether the road is well marked, whether a place is either well lit or just the weather and so many other factors. So putting those particular sort of variables or parameters in place, you have to define the constraints of your system. You have to define what your system can do and not do. And the user needs to understand by using this particular AI system, you understand that it can only do this much. So even in the case of ChatGPT, I'm sure in the terms and conditions, or even as you're about to enter your first prompt, it tells you, a certain version of ChatGPT will tell you, I can only access data until this particular date, let's say September 2021. Anything before that or after that, I'm not able to access. So if you ask me anything beyond that, then I won't be able to give you the particular output. So in this case, the user is fully liable because you have been informed and you agree and you understand that this particular system that I'm using has this particular limitation. So most of the times when things go wrong, so even in the case of the Tesla accident, they're able to go back, look at the data and actually see, we had told the user, if this car is in self-driving mode, you need to be alert, right? In cases where the car feels like it needs you to take back control, it will alert you that, hey, you need to take over the steering wheel. The way I'm seeing this road, I don't think I'm able to navigate. And in this case, let's say the user is sleeping and they don't take control of the cars, the car is instructing them, then in such case, the user is fully liable. However, if it is proven that the user actually followed the instruction that was shared by the AI system, whether it slowed down or get off the road and something else still happened, then the liability now goes to the particular system. So it just depends with the moving
context.
Parts.
Depends on context.
Yes.
In fact, when you spoke about sleeping, literally an image went through my mind of a reel I have seen of a lady who was sleeping in her Tesla on a highway in America. Yes. And that image just went through my mind. And I was like, yeah, that's true. Actually, that lady was sleeping. So if a prompt such as that was given by the system, should not have been alert enough to respond to it. And then, of course, now that would have been a whole other story.
Yeah.
Now, I want to ask you my final question, and I want to ask this on exactly what we've been talking about. What do you think... I've asked you about the future of AI in Kenya, but I'd say the last question I want to ask you is, how can we ensure that the use of AI systems is both ethical and legal? And we can thus now narrow it down to our context, because I know when you began working in this space, we didn't even have data protection regulations. I mean, it was like free for all with our data.
Yes.
But at least now we have a commissioner for data protection, we have a data protection act, and we're working on the systems that need to be in place so that we can have some sort of legal boundary within which we can operate.
Yeah.
And ethics is neither here nor there, but how can we ensure that the systems operate going forward in a more ethical and legal way?
The first thing I'd like to say is we are currently a global village. So the ChatGPT that is used in US is the same that is being used in Kenya. There's no Kenyan version of it. So basically, because we have the internet, technology has become super accessible, right? So we have to closely monitor the advancement on a global scale. And we have to look at how are we protecting ourselves or how are we advancing even as the technology advances. So that means we should not keep waiting for the European or American or Asian markets to come up with a regulation. And then it's when we follow up and we say, oh, these guys have launched GDPR. We're also going to launch GDPR.
Let me just tell them what GDPR is. So for our guests in the EU, in the European Union, there is I would call it the definitive data protection mechanism for regulating data protection, and it's called the Global Data Protection Regulations, GDPR. So back to you.
Yeah, so in that case, if you see another market has launched GDPR, so it's a good standard to look at and use it as a benchmark to have our own version. But the next time there's a super advancement in AI that is easily accessible through the internet, we will be able to access it. So what measures have we put in place to fully understand how these technologies work, and also to prepare ourselves accordingly and educate as many people as possible on understanding this is what the technology can do. This is how you try and remain relevant even as it is advancing. And lastly, how do we collaborate from government to academia and the private sector? How do we share the different advancement use cases and best practices that we are seeing in those different areas? Yeah.
I like you. I like what you've said. And I think that technology always goes faster than the law. That is it's historical.
Yeah.
So I think that we can protect ourselves as robustly as we can, but we also just have to be cognizant of the fact that technology will keep moving, and we just have to keep moving with it.
Yes.
And that's the end of that particular discussion.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the end of this episode. I'd like to thank my guest, Alfred Ongere. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I am your host, Jean Kambuni. I'd also like to remind our listeners that this episode is part of a two-episode series on AI. Take a listen to part one, recorded with Natasha Ochiel, co-founder and head of business and partnerships at Artificial Intelligence Center of Excellence Africa, to get an understanding of AI in general and its opportunities and threats. But also, take a look at the fourth edition of the GVA Legal Magazine. It's all about the rise of artificial intelligence. Tell us what you think about this episode and our new format in the comment section of our social media pages or on email. Our email address is info@gvalawfirm.com. You can also follow Gikera and Badgama Advocates on social media. You can find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as GVA Law Firm. Thank you again for joining us on the GVA Legal Podcast.